Today on Wings, women take a deep look at Myanmar's war against the Rohingya population of Rakhine State.
Aung San Suu Kyi does not have the constitutional powers to stop the persecution, but General Min has, and he's not doing anything about it.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Myanmar, the country formerly known as Burma, is wedged between India, China, and Southeast Asia, but it occupies a very long coastline. Rakhine State, at the west end of the coast, adjoins Bangladesh, a tiny region carved off of India in 1947, designated for Muslims. At present, an estimated 800,000 Rohingya have fled to Bangladesh. Burma's coast also flows down a long peninsula shared with Thailand. The tip of that peninsula belongs to Malaysia, another mainly Muslim country, which has an estimated 150,000 Rohingya refugees. Media women who work with these refugees talk to Giselle Hanna on her Australia-based community radio program, Accent of Women.
Hello and welcome to Accent of Women, a show by and about women from diverse cultures and languages right across the world. I'm Giselle Hanna. On today's Accent of Women, we look at the refugee crisis in Rakhine State, Burma, or Myanmar, and the military junta's attempts there to exterminate the Rohingya ethnic minority. At least 500,000 Rohingya have fled to neighbouring Bangladesh since August of this year. Officially, Burma's government does not recognise the Rohingya as lawful citizens. The government claims they were brought to Rakhine from Bangladesh during the time when Burma was a British colony, and the government says they're living in Burma illegally. But there are other factors too that lie behind the brutal genocide of the Rohingya: economic considerations, access to natural resources, as well as the broader global context of warfare and anti-Muslim sentiment. To discuss the Rohingya refugee crisis and the genocide, I speak with two media makers and activists in Asia, in the receiving countries for Rohingya refugees. Both of these activists have spent time in the Rohingya refugee camps and are active in the struggle against the violence, oppression and genocide of the Rohingya people. You'll be hearing from Parsa Sanjana Sajid, who's a writer, editor and researcher in Bangladesh. She teaches at the Independent University Bangladesh and edits Fragments magazine. Also, Mahi Ramakrishnan, a documentary filmmaker in Malaysia who's been covering the Rohingya crisis for many years and has made three documentaries about the issue. First up, Parsa Sanjana Sajid.
I would say the crisis was created by the state of Myanmar as soon as they stripped the Rohingyas of their citizenship and any other rights they had. The Rohingya population was made stateless and targeted for expulsion and systematic violence, which obviously made them flee Myanmar. And also, it's now been very, very well documented that in addition to forced expulsion, that the military carried out systematic campaigns of violence against them, which now, after this latest crisis, the UN is calling it a quote-unquote textbook example of ethnic cleansing. I would call it a genocide, going by, you know, the general definition of the word, but the politics of what is and isn't a genocide is rather murky.
Clearly, the Burmese military is interested in either extinguishing or forcing out of the country all of the Rohingya. Why is that the case? Why won't the Burmese government or the Burmese military grant citizenship to the Rohingya?
Why won't they grant? I mean, as far as the Burmese government is concerned, they wouldn't recognize Rohingyas because for them, the Rohingyas are Bengalis, right, and migrants from Bangladesh. So I don't think it's a matter of can't. I think it's a matter of won't, that they just don't recognize the Rohingya population as an ethnic group within Myanmar. They refuse to even recognize the term and terms the Rohingya population, who are self-identified as Rohingyas, as Bengalis. But I would also like to add that I think there is also widespread support among the population for this state insistence that they are Bengalis. On the other hand, these divisions, this labeling of who is and isn't a Rohingya, were largely created and fomented by the successive Myanmar ruling class, namely the military.
Mahi Ramakrishna adds these thoughts to the origins and genesis of the Rohingya crisis.
Actually, a lot of people tend to look at this conflict as a religious conflict, Buddhists against the Muslims. And now currently there's been this issue of pitting the Hindus against the Muslims. But if you really go deeper and do some investigation, you'll find out that Arakan in itself is a place, a state which is rich with natural resources. Like other parts of Burma are rich with gemstones, for example. Arakan is a great place for fishing, has got gas. And recently, in 2014, if I'm not mistaken, the military found out that the beaches of Mongdor has got a black soil, which is rich with titanium and aluminium. So what is essentially happening in Burma is genocide against the Rohingya, because the military wants to make sure that the entire population of the Rohingya are chased out of the state in whichever manner possible, so that it has full and unrestricted access to the natural resources and also the land. If you look at Burma's history, you'll know that there are hundreds of thousands of land grab cases in Burma, amounting to 3 to 5 million acres of land which has been grabbed. And this is sold to investors, and investors are given even government loans while the smallholders get nothing. So this is a history of persecution to make sure that the military stays in control of logistics, of resources, and that it stays rich and powerful.
It's not a surprise that the basis of the conflict lies in capitalism, or some kind of profit grab by the government, by the military, by those with interests in those profits. But you are right at the same time that this debate is being cast as either a religious or a cultural debate, that the Rohingya are being persecuted because of their Islamic religion, because of their different ethnicity, or arguably different ethnicity from the rest of Burma. How is that idea maintained, given that Burma is so multicultural?
See, if you really look at, now we are all so focused on the Rohingya issue, but the history of persecution is more than 3 decades old, and it's not just the Rohingya who have been persecuted. The Rohingya, there is a small group of Hindu Rohingya who have also been persecuted, and the Kachin, the Chin, the Karen. I was in Burma in 2013, and I heard lots of stories about how the military will be driving past a Kachin village only to see a very pretty girl. The military will stop and will just grab the woman, and she's lost forever. She just completely disappears. So this kind of persecution has been going on. And in Burma, even the majority Burmese are poor and discriminated upon. It's not just the Rohingya. In Rakhine state itself, the Rakhine Buddhists remain poor. Arakan is the poorest state in Burma, with 78% poverty rate. So now, if we look at what's happening in Burma, we see the persecution against the Rohingya because it's so visible. But don't be surprised if, after the Rohingya have been chased out of Arakan, you will also see the military training its weapons against the Rakhine Buddhists. Now, it may not end up in a massacre or the kind of slaughter that we are seeing against the Rohingya, but they will also be driven out of the state because, like I said, all that the military is concerned about is the control of the natural resources. So Burma's military has systematically persecuted against all its ethnic groups for more than 3 decades now. The only people who are rich, who are powerful, and who remain safe are the military, the ruling elite, the rich people, and those who are cronies of these people.
Well, I want to go back to the Rohingya, and I do take on board what you're saying, that today it's the Rohingya being persecuted, but you know, if the Burmese military succeeds in sweeping them out of the country entirely, there is a new target of that military aggression. However, today they are being targeted, and it does make headlines, so we must talk about it. And you, as a documentary filmmaker, you managed to get into some of the refugee camps in order to make the documentaries and to get beneath the stories. How difficult was it to actually get into the camps?
It took me almost a year to get the permission, because I do know that some journalists and filmmakers have actually tried and have entered the camps without proper permission, but it is extremely dangerous. And it will also kind of like not give you that kind of access that you want when you want to film and you want to talk to as many people as possible. So it actually took me close to a year, and I had to use a contact in Yangon to lobby for a permission. And finally, I got it. And that's how I ended up going up to Arakan, and they allowed me to visit the internally displaced people's camps for 3 days. What I saw there was terrible, because there was a stark contrast between the IDP camps built for the Rohingya as opposed to the ones built for the Rakhine Buddhists. Now, the Rakhine Buddhist ones were better structured. They were built on stilts. There was even a school there, and there was enough facilities, running water. You can get access to water as well. But the ones built for the Rohingya were appalling. There were not enough toilets for thousands and thousands of the Rohingyas in the IDP camps. There was no running water, so there was lots of disease. There was not enough food, even though World Food Program was operating out of Arakan. They weren't able to actually supply enough for the people because of rampant corruption involving state ministers and middlemen. So it was a terrible condition. And, you know, there was a popular notion going around at that time in 2013, where people said that if you really notice, you will know that the IDP camps for the Rohingya were built close to the Bay of Bengal, because the Burmese government is just hoping that in the event there's another tsunami, then it'll wipe them all out and they don't really have to embark on another exercise to find a way to drive them out of Arakan.
So on the one hand, the Burmese military is hoping that these people die. That is a part of the genocide exercise. But pushing them across the border, where are these people expected to go?
See, the thing is that these people now, the only access that they have is to Bangladesh. Because the sea route, where they use the sea to come to Thailand and then to Malaysia, is shut because of stringent monitoring following the 2015-2016 boat crisis. So it's being monitored by not just Malaysia, but also Thailand as well as Indonesia. So the easiest, the quickest way for them to escape the persecution, the butchering, the beheadings and the violence is to actually flee into Bangladesh. So they really have no choice. And I'm sure you have heard news about landmines on the way, because it is the tactic used by the Burmese military to ensure that the Rohingya do not even think about coming back, about going back to Burma. So that is the kind of genocide exercise which is being undertaken by the military regime.
A lot is being made of Aung San Suu Kyi's silence on the issue, in fact, her acquiescence to what the military is doing. Are you surprised at all by her non-response to the international community about the genocide?
See, I'm one of those people who grew up, looking at her like as if though she's some kind of a goddess. Like, she truly was a democracy icon to me. And it was such a disappointment when she failed to stand up to the persecution, the killings, and the genocide against the Rohingya. But having seen the way she has been responding to the news about the Rohingya, it came as no surprise that she is continuing her stand. But having said that, you know, it's also very interesting about how all of us are talking about Aung San Suu Kyi and not General Min, who is the most powerful person in Burma. He is the only person who can actually stop the killings. He is the only person who can tell the military to stop shooting. And yet, no one talks about him. And all of us are focused on Aung San Suu Kyi. I'm not saying that what she's doing is right. I'm not saying that we shouldn't be talking about her. I'm just saying that we should also be looking at General Min, who, despite the European Union sanctions, still being in place, was given an incredible welcome when he went to Europe last year. He had guards of honor, red carpet treatment, and was also allowed to speak. He had speaking invitations and engagements. Now, this is appalling. It is incredible that countries like Britain has said that, you know, they will stop the training, the military training. And that is incredible. But we really need more countries, more people, more advocates, more human rights people, and more people in the UN to actually start talking about the general, because he is the most powerful person. Aung San Suu Kyi does not have the constitutional powers to stop the persecution, but General Min has, and he's not doing anything about it.
On Wings, you are listening to an episode of the community radio program Accent of Women. This one is titled, The Rohingya Crisis is Genocide. The host is Giselle Hanna.
We've been hearing from Mahi Ramakrishnan, a documentary and filmmaker based in Malaysia, discussing the Rohingya refugee crisis. Earlier, we heard from Parsa Sanjana Sajid about her thoughts on the origins of the crisis. More from Parsa.
Just to start off, I would like to stress that the Burmese government has been fighting ethnic tensions across the country, and there are insurgencies across the country in other regions in Burma too. So it's not that they're only fighting the Rohingyas. So the multicultural aspect in the country has always been very restrictive. Who allows, who is allowed to participate is up to and at the behest of the state of Myanmar. But if we actually think about the region without a border, pre-nation state, I think it becomes a bit easier to understand. So the region, present-day Chittagong, which is now in Bangladesh, and the Rakhine state, which is in Myanmar, which the Rohingyas call home, these two regions have had shared cultural, political, economic, social history dating back to at least the 8th century, documented. And I don't want to project a history without tensions and conflict, but be that as it may, it has had an intermingled history where people of the region throughout that history, through intermarriage, have come to share that, shared history. During the British colonial period, we saw another kind of mass migration into that region where people from India, but I'm calling India as kind of pre-nation state India, so other parts of the Indian subcontinent, Greater Bengal, also what is now Pakistan, moved to or were taken by the British to work as professionals in the British administration, but also to work as laborers in the plantations. So in post-independence Burma, along with a nascent nationalist sentiment, there was kind of tensions against the people from communities who had ties to India or communities with Indian origin. And Rohingyas became also kind of labeled as people with Indian origins, or, you know, Bengalis. When independence happened, there was nascent nationalist sentiment in the country, this idea to bring the country together. And in that, people from Indian origin, which included the Rohingya population, became a target, that they were actually outsiders and they could not be included in kind of national imaginary or national polity in Burma. So these tensions persisted, although there are obviously evidence that Rohingyas participated in elections, in political life, despite spates of violence and expulsion throughout the 60s and 70s. But the culmination of the tension basically came in 1982 when the citizenship law in Burma basically stripped Rohingyas of any citizenship claims and basically excluded them from participation in any political life, stripped them of any rights. So going back to the British period, I mean, there were other conflicts in other regions in Myanmar, and the British exploited that. So if the British exploited the inter-ethnic tensions to pit groups against each other, to rule over, you know, Myanmar and India in post-independence Burma, in kind of the drive to make a cohesive society, multiculturalism, this idea of multiculturalism became an instrument. So this idea of citizenship in the country is tied to the idea of national race, which I would say is a very dangerous idea. And it's tied to European colonial assumptions about race. But in the Burmese, all these acts and in the constitution, although they recognize national races, right, and which excludes or does not include Rohingyas as a national race, don't really explain what constitutes a race. But then again, we also know defining race has always been based on pseudoscience. It's always racism. So there is this, you know, idea of that, and because of that shared cultural history, because the language that the Rohingyas speak are somewhat similar to the languages spoken in Chittagong, which is again in Bangladesh, there is this idea that they must be from there. Although there is also, you know, quite well-documented history of people of in that region dating back to centuries ago.
We know that many of the Rohingya refugees are now in Bangladesh. Many of them are seeking to cross that border. In fact, that looks like the last remaining open border for the Rohingya, for the Burmese Rohingya to cross into. But we've also learned that there are landmines along that border too. So as people are fleeing, they are dying in bombings along the border. Do you know what the conditions are like along the border? What's happening there?
Okay, so I was actually down there just last week. And the conditions change from week to week and even from day to day. So it's very difficult to, you know, say something today and then things will change. But what I can say generally is that the refugees are still streaming in. Even just 2 or 3 days ago, there was an incident where a boat carrying refugees across the Naf River capsized, killing several people. So, yes, people are still fleeing, but we do have reports of landmine along the borders, which is basically now the situation is quite perverse. It's on the one hand, the military would rather see these people expelled from their homelands. But with the latest influx, there has also been evidence. People have come with stories of violence and murder. And it seems that while making sure that these people flee, somehow the military is reacting in a way that people will also not be allowed to flee. But mind you, the border area is very remote and despite all efforts can also be porous. So people are still trying to flee, you know, across the rivers, the forests and the hills. When I was down there in Cox's Bazar, I heard from a woman who had just arrived that the rest of her family is in a village called Boli Bazar in Myanmar, or near Boli Bazar in Myanmar. And the military has surrounded and laid siege to that village. And she doesn't know whether they will ever be, you know, allowed out or the military will, in fact, kill them all.
Well, we know that part of the genocide exercise is to turn non-Rohingya Burmese against the Rohingya. So we have this broader discontent among ordinary citizens of the country. How are Bangladeshis responding to the influx of Rohingya refugees? Is there a similar demonization of the Rohingya?
I'm really actually glad that you asked this question. And I would also like to add that there has been Rohingyas in Bangladesh successively throughout the last 20, 30 years. In recent history, before this latest influx in the 90s, early 90s, there was a huge number of people that came in again due to violence. And some of them were repatriated. So we have had Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh for quite some time, even before this latest crisis. Before this latest influx, I would say, and it's my opinion, that the sentiment towards Rohingyas ran from ambivalence to outright dislike. Obviously, there were exceptions. Obviously, there were some groups, people, institutions that were more generous. With the current influx that started recently, there's been a marked change. People at every level, institutions, individuals, are indeed showing a spirit of generosity. They're helping Rohingyas with relief and aid. But I would like to actually stress that there is an underbelly to that, which is that that spirit of generosity is also shot with an extreme sense of nationalism, which is specifically, it's basically, look at how generous we are. Look at how we are helping the people in distress. So there's a bit of contingency in that feeling, in that generosity, because it depends on the Rohingya population's extreme abjection, right? They're extremely victimized. If they were, you know, they actually just moved a bit from extreme victimization, I'm not too sure that we would actually show this sympathy. Also, concurrent with humanitarian assistance, and which is not actually covered that frequently in the press, our international press, is that we have seen one after another anti-refugee policy and sentiment in the country. Newspapers, even yesterday, Prothom Alo, which is one of the primary Bangla newspapers in the country, ran a headline that said the Rohingyas are spreading all over the country. And these types of headlines are quite frequent. And as if the Rohingyas and the refugees are a disease, as if they need to be contained. There is also widespread support, even among people who are doing humanitarian work, people who are coming forward with help, that Rohingyas need to be fenced in, they need to be enclosed in the camps, and that we need to restrict their mobility. There's been reports of Rohingyas being picked up from outside the camps and sent to the camps. The government has issued directives that Rohingyas cannot be issued mobile SIM cards, that there will be phones in the camps with which they can call their relatives or whoever, but they won't be allowed to have mobile phones in the country. Landlords will not be allowed to rent. Employers won't be allowed to employ Rohingyas. Of course, like in any other country, people are doing all of these things, but it means that they're doing it outside of the law, in breach of the law, and that these laws are ultimately immoral.
You are listening to Parsa Sanjana Sajid, a writer, editor, and researcher in Bangladesh. She teaches at the Independent University, Bangladesh, and edits Fragments magazine. If you want to access Fragments magazine, go to fragmentsmagazine.com. And before her, Mahi Ramakrishnan, a documentary and filmmaker in Malaysia who's been covering the Rohingya crisis for many years.
Wings thanks Giselle Hanna and Accent of Women for sharing this program. Please check our news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio or email wings@wings.org for more info. Thanks to all Wings supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wing Sound logo is from Lee Bana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.